Chapter 6. The next morning at breakfast, Jotham Powell was between them, and Ethan tried to hide his joy under an air of exaggerated indifference, lounging back in his chair to throw scraps to the cat, growling at the weather, and not so much as offering to help Maddie when she rose to clear away the dishes. He did not know why he was so irrationally happy, for nothing was changed in his life or hers. He had not even touched the tip of her fingers or looked her full in the eyes. But their evening together had given him a vision of what life at her side might be, and he was glad now that he had done nothing to trouble the sweetness of the picture. He had a fancy that she knew what had restrained him. There was a last load of lumber to be hauled to the village, and Jotham Powell, who did not work regularly for Ethan in winter, had come round to help with the job. But a wet snow, melting to sleet, had fallen in the night and turned the roads to glass. There was more wet in the air, and it seemed likely to both men that the weather would milden toward afternoon and make the going safer. Ethan therefore proposed to his assistant that they should load the sledge at the woodlot, as they had done on the previous morning, and put off the teaming to Starkfield till later in the day. This plan had the advantage of enabling him to send Jotham to the flats after dinner to meet Zenobia, while he himself took the lumber down to the village. He told Jotham to go out and harness up the greys, and for a moment he and Maddie had the kitchen to themselves. She had plunged the breakfast dishes into a tin dishpan and was bending above it with her slim arms bared to the elbow, the steam from the hot water beating her forehead and tightening her rough hair into little brown rings like the tendrils on the traveler's joy. Ethan stood looking at her, his heart in his throat. He wanted to say, "We shall never be alone again like this." Instead, he reached down his tobacco pouch from the shelf of the dresser, put it into his pocket, and said, "I guess I can make out to be home for dinner." She answered, "All right, Ethan," and he heard her singing over the dishes as he went. As soon as the sledge was loaded, he meant to send Jotham back to the farm and hurry on foot into the village to buy the glue for the pickle dish. With ordinary luck, he should have had time to carry out this plan, but everything went wrong from the start. On the way over to the woodlot, one of the greys slipped on a glare of ice and cut his knee, and when they got him up again, Jotham had to go back to the barn for a strip of rag to bind the cut. Then, when the loading finally began, a sleety rain was coming down once more, and the tree trunks were so slippery that it took twice as long as usual to lift them and get them in place on the sledge. It was what Jotham called a sour morning for work, and the horses, shivering and stamping under their wet blankets, seemed to like it as little as the men. It was long past the dinner hour when the job was done, and Ethan had to give up going to the village because he wanted to lead the injured horse home and wash the cut himself. He had thought that by starting out again with the lumber as soon as he had finished his dinner, he might get back to the farm with the glue before Jotham and the old sorrel had had time to fetch Zenobia from the flats, but he knew the chance was a slight one. It turned on the state of the roads and on the possible lateness of the Bettsbridge train. He remembered afterward, with a grim flash of self-derision, what importance he had attached to the weighing of these probabilities. As soon as dinner was over, he set out again for the woodlot, not daring to linger till Jotham Powell left. The hired man was still drying his wet feet at the stove, and Ethan could only give Maddie a quick look as he said beneath his breath, "I'll be back early." He fancied that she nodded her comprehension, and with that scant solace he had to trudge off through the rain. He had driven his load halfway to the village when Jotham Powell overtook him, urging the reluctant sorrel toward the flats. "I'll have to hurry up to do it," Ethan mused as the sleigh dropped down ahead of him over the dip of the schoolhouse hill. He worked like 10 at the unloading, and when it was over hastened on to Michael Edie's for the glue. Edie and his assistant were both down street, and young Dennis, who seldom deigned to take their place, was lounging by the stove with a nod of the golden youth of Starkfield. They hailed Ethan with ironic compliment and offers of conviviality, but no one knew where to find the glue. Ethan, consumed with the longing for a last moment with Maddie, hung about impatiently while Dennis made an ineffectual search in the obscure corners of the store. "Looks as if we were all sold out, but if you'll wait around till the old man comes along, maybe he can put his hand on it." "I'm obliged to you, but I'll try if I can get it down at Mrs. Holman's," Ethan answered, burning to be gone. Dennis's commercial instinct compelled him to aver on an oath that what Edie's store could not produce would never be found at the Widow Holman's. But Ethan, heedless of this boast, had already climbed to the sledge and was driving on to the rival establishment. Here, after considerable search and sympathetic questions as to what he wanted it for, and whether ordinary flour paste wouldn't do as well if she couldn't find it, the Widow Holman finally hunted down her solitary bottle of glue to its hiding place in a medley of cough lozenges and corset laces. "I hope Zena ain't broken anything she set store by," she called after him as he turned the grays toward home. The fitful bursts of sleet had changed into a steady rain, and the horses had heavy work even without a load behind them. Once or twice, hearing sleigh bells, Ethan turned his head, fancying that Zena and Jotham might overtake him. But the old sorrel was not in sight, and he set his face against the rain and urged on his ponderous pair. The barn was empty when the horses turned into it, and after giving them the most perfunctory ministrations they had ever received from him, he strode up to the house and pushed open the kitchen door. Maddie was there alone, as he had pictured her. She was bending over a pan on the stove, but at the sound of his step she turned with a start and sprang to him. "See here, Matt, I've got some stuff to mend the dish with. Let me get at it quick," he cried, waving the bottle in one hand while he put her lightly aside. But she did not seem to hear him.
"Oh, Ethan, Zena's come," she said in a whisper, clutching his sleeve.
They stood and stared at each other, pale as culprits.
"But the sorrel's not in the barn," Ethan stammered.
"Jotham Powell brought some goods over from the flats for his wife, and he drove right on home with them," she explained. He gazed blankly about the kitchen, which looked cold and squalid in the rainy winter twilight. "How is she?" he asked, dropping his voice to Maddie's whisper. She looked away from him uncertainly.
"I don't know. She went right up to her room."
"She didn't say anything?"
"No."
Ethan let out his doubts in a low whistle and thrust the bottle back into his pocket. "Don't fret. I'll come down and mend it in the night," he said. He pulled on his wet coat again and went back to the barn to feed the grays. While he was there, Jotham Powell drove up with the sleigh, and when the horses had been attended to, Ethan said to him, "You might as well come back up for a bite." He was not sorry to assure himself of Jotham's neutralizing presence at the dinner table, for Zena was always nervous after a journey. But the hired man, though seldom loath to accept a meal not included in his wages, opened his stiff jaws to answer slowly, "I'm obliged to you, but I guess I'll go long back." Ethan looked at him in surprise. "Better come up and dry off. Looks as if there'd be something hot for supper." Jotham's facial muscles were unmoved by this appeal, and, his vocabulary being limited, he merely repeated, "I guess I'll go along back." To Ethan, there was something vaguely ominous in this stolid rejection of free food and warmth, and he wondered what had happened on the drive to nerve Jotham to such stoicism. Perhaps Zena had failed to see the new doctor, or had not liked his counsels. Ethan knew that in such cases the first person she met was likely to be held responsible for her grievance. When he re-entered the kitchen, the lamp lit up the same scene of shining comfort as on the previous evening. The table had been as carefully laid. A clear fire glowed in the stove. The cat dozed in its warmth, and Maddie came forward carrying a plate of doughnuts. She and Ethan looked at each other in silence. Then she said, as she had said the night before, "I guess it's about time for supper."
Chapter 7.
Ethan went out into the passage to hang up his wet garments. He listened for Zena's step, and not hearing it, called her name up the stairs. She did not answer, and after a moment's hesitation, he went up and opened her door. The room was almost dark, but in the obscurity he saw her sitting by the window, bolt upright, and knew by the rigidity of the outline projected against the pane that she had not taken off her traveling dress. "Well, Zena?" he ventured from the household. She did not move, and he continued, "Supper's about ready. Ain't you coming?" She replied, "I don't feel as if I could touch a morsel." It was the consecrated formula, and he expected it to be followed, as usual, by her rising and going down to supper. But she remained seated, and he could think of nothing more felicitous than, "I presume you're tired after the long ride." Turning her head at this, she answered solemnly, "I'm a great deal sicker than you think." Her words fell on his ear with a strange shock of wonder. He had often heard her pronounce them before. What if at last they were true? He advanced a step or two into the dim room. "I hope that's not so, Zena," he said. She continued to gaze at him through the twilight with a mien of wan authority, as of one consciously singled out for a great fate. "I've got complications," she said. Ethan knew the word for one of exceptional import. Almost everybody in the neighborhood had troubles, frankly localized and specified, but only the chosen had complications. To have them was in itself a distinction, though it was also, in most cases, a death warrant. People struggled on for years with troubles, but they almost always succumbed to complications. Ethan's heart was jerking to and fro between two extremities of feeling, but for the moment compassion prevailed. His wife looked so hard and lonely sitting there in the darkness with such thoughts. "Is that what the new doctor told you?" he asked, instinctively lowering his voice. "Yes. He says any regular doctor would want me to have an operation." Ethan was aware that, in regard to the important question of surgical intervention, the female opinion of the neighborhood was divided, some glorying in the prestige conferred by operations, while others shunned them as indelicate. Ethan, from motives of economy, had always been glad that Zena was of the latter faction. In the agitation caused by the gravity of her announcement, he sought a consolatory shortcut. "What do you know about this doctor, anyway? Nobody ever told you that before." He saw his blunder before she could take it up. She wanted sympathy, not consolation. "I didn't need to have anybody tell me I was losing ground every day. Everybody but you could see it. And everybody in Bettsbridge knows about Dr. Buck. He has his office in Worcester and comes over once a fortnight to Shadds Falls and Bettsbridge for consultations. Eliza Spears was wasting away with kidney trouble before she went to him, and now she's up and around and singing in the choir."
"Well, I'm glad of that. You must do just what he tells you," Ethan answered sympathetically.
She was still looking at him.
"I mean to,"
she said. He was struck by a new note in her voice. It was neither whining nor reproachful, but dryly resolute.
"And what does he want you should do?" he asked, with a mounting vision of fresh expenses.
"He wants I should have a hired girl. He says I oughtn't to have to do a single thing around the house."
"A hired girl?" Ethan stood transfixed.
"Yes, and Aunt Martha found me one right off. Everybody says I was lucky to get a girl to come away out here, and I agreed to give her a dollar extra to make sure. She'll be over tomorrow afternoon."
Wrath and dismay contended in Ethan. He had foreseen an immediate demand for money, but not a permanent drain on his scant resources. He no longer believed what Xena had told him of the supposed seriousness of her state. He saw in her expedition to Bettsbridge only a plot hatched between herself and her Pierce relations to foist on him the cost of a servant, and for the moment wrath predominated. "If you meant to engage a girl, you ought to have told me before you started," he said. "How could I tell you before I started? How did I know what Dr. Buck would say?" "Oh, Dr. Buck." Ethan's incredulity escaped in a short laugh. "Did Dr. Buck tell you how I was to pay her wages?" Her voice rose furiously with his. "No, he didn't, for I'd have been ashamed to tell him that you grudged me the money to get back my health when I lost it nursing your own mother." "You lost your health nursing mother?" "Yes, and my folks all told me at the time you couldn't do no less than marry me after Xena." Through the obscurity which hid their faces, their thoughts seemed to dart at each other like serpents shooting venom. Ethan was seized with horror of the scene and shame at his own share in it. It was as senseless and savage as a physical fight between two enemies in the darkness. He turned to the shelf above the chimney, groped for matches, and lit the one candle in the room. At first its weak flame made no impression on the shadows. Then Xena's face stood grimly out against the uncurtained pane, which had turned from gray to black. It was the first scene of open anger between the couple in their sad 7 years together, and Ethan felt as if he had lost an irretrievable advantage in descending to the level of recrimination. But the practical problem was there and had to be dealt with. "You know I haven't got the money to pay for a girl, Xena. You'll have to send her back. I can't do it." "The doctor says it'll be my death if I go on slaving the way I've had to. He doesn't understand how I've stood it as long as I have." "Slaving?" He checked himself again. "You shan't lift a hand if he says so. I'll do everything round the house myself," she broke in. "You're neglecting the farm enough already." And this being true, he found no answer, and left her time to add ironically, "Better send me over to the almshouse and done with it. I guess there's been Fromes there afore now." The taunt burned into him, but he let it pass. "I haven't got the money. That settles it." There was a moment's pause in the struggle, as though the combatants were testing their weapons. Then Xena said in a level voice, "I thought you were to get $50 from Andrew Hale for that lumber." "Andrew Hale never pays under 3 months." He had hardly spoken when he remembered the excuse he had made for not accompanying his wife to the station the day before, and the blood rose to his frowning brows. "Why, you told me yesterday you'd fixed it up with him to pay cash down. You said that was why you couldn't drive me over to the flats." Ethan had no suppleness in deceiving. He had never before been convicted of a lie, and all the resources of evasion failed him. "I guess that was a misunderstanding," he stammered. "You ain't got the money?"
"No."
"And you ain't going to get it?"
"No."
"Well, I couldn't know that when I engaged the girl, could I?"
"No."
He paused to control his voice.
"But you know it now. I'm sorry, but it can't be helped. You're a poor man's wife, Xena, but I'll do the best I can for you."
For a while she sat motionless, as if reflecting, her arms stretched along the arms of her chair, her eyes fixed on vacancy. "Oh, I guess we'll make out," she said mildly. The change in her tone reassured him.
"Of course we will. There's a whole lot more I can do for you, and Maddie..."
Xena, while he spoke, seemed to be following out some elaborate mental calculation. She emerged from it to say, "There'll be Maddie's board less, anyhow." Ethan, supposing the discussion to be over, had turned to go down to supper. He stopped short, not grasping what he heard.
"Maddie's board less?" he began.
Xena laughed. It was an odd, unfamiliar sound. He did not remember ever having heard her laugh before. You didn't suppose I was going to keep two girls, did you? No wonder you were scared at the expense.
He still had but a confused sense of what she was saying. From the beginning of the discussion, he had instinctively avoided the mention of Maddie's name, fearing he hardly knew what. Criticism, complaints, or vague allusions to the imminent probability of her marrying. But the thought of a definite rupture had never come to him, and even now could not lodge itself in his mind.
"I don't know what you mean," he said. "Maddie Silver is not a hired girl. She's your relation."
"She's a pauper that's hung on to us all after her father done his best to ruin us. I've kept her here a whole year. It's somebody else's turn now."
As the shrill words shot out, Ethan heard a tap on the door, which he had drawn shut when he turned back from the threshold.
"Ethan! Zena!" Maddie's voice sounded gaily from the landing. "Do you know what time it is? Supper's been ready half an hour."
Inside the room there was a moment's silence. Then Zena called out from her seat,
"I'm not coming down to supper."
"Oh, I'm sorry. Aren't you well? Shan't I bring you up a bite of something?"
Ethan roused himself with an effort and opened the door.
"Go along down, Matt. Zena's just a little tired. I'm coming."
He heard her, "All right," and her quick step on the stairs. Then he shut the door and turned back into the room. His wife's attitude was unchanged, her face inexorable, and he was seized with a despairing sense of his helplessness.
"You ain't going to do it, Zena."
"Do what?" she emitted between flattened lips.
"Send Maddie away, like this?"
"I never bargained to take her for life."
He continued with rising vehemence.
"You can't put her out of the house like a thief, a poor girl without friends or money. She's done her best for you, and she's got no place to go to. You may forget she's your kin, but everybody else'll remember it. If you do a thing like that, what do you suppose folks'll say of you?"
Zena waited a moment, as if giving him time to feel the full force of the contrast between his own excitement and her composure. Then she replied in the same smooth voice,
"I know well enough what they say of my having kept her here as long as I have."
Ethan's hand dropped from the doorknob, which he had held clenched since he had drawn the door shut on Maddie. His wife's retort was like a knife cut across the sinews, and he felt suddenly weak and powerless. He had meant to humble himself, to argue that Maddie's keep didn't cost much after all, that he could make out to buy a stove and fix up a place in the attic for the hired girl, but Zena's words revealed the peril of such pleadings.
"You mean to tell her she's got to go at once?"
he faltered out, in terror of letting his wife complete her sentence. As if trying to make him see reason, she replied impartially,
"The girl will be over from Bettsbridge tomorrow, and I presume she's got to have somewheres to sleep."
Ethan looked at her with loathing. She was no longer the listless creature who had lived at his side in a state of sullen self-absorption, but a mysterious alien presence, an evil energy secreted in the long years of silent brooding. It was the sense of his helplessness that sharpened his antipathy. There had never been anything in her that one could appeal to, but as long as he could ignore and command, he had remained indifferent. Now she had mastered him, and he abhorred her. Maddie was her relation, not his. There were no means by which he could compel her to keep the girl under her roof. All the long misery of his baffled past, of his youth of failure, hardship, and vain effort, rose up in his soul in bitterness and seemed to take shape before him in the woman who at every turn had barred his way. She had taken everything else from him, and now she meant to take the one thing that had made up for all the others. For a moment, such a flame of hate rose in him that it ran down his arm and clenched his fist against her. He took a wild step forward and then stopped.
You're not coming down," he said in a bewildered voice.
"No, I guess I'll lay down on the bed a little while," she answered mildly,
and he turned and walked out of the room.
In the kitchen, Maddie was sitting by the stove, the cat curled up on her knees. She sprang to her feet as Ethan entered and carried the covered dish of meat pie to the table.
"I hope Zena isn't sick," she asked.
"No." She shone at him across the table.
"Well, sit right down, then. You must be starving."
She uncovered the pie and pushed it over to him. So they were to have one more evening together, her happy eyes seemed to say. He helped himself mechanically and began to eat. Then disgust took him by the throat and he laid down his fork. Maddie's tender gaze was on him and she marked the gesture.
"Why, Ethan, what's the matter? Don't it taste right?"
"Yes, it's first rate. Only I..." He pushed his plate away, rose from his chair and walked around the table to her side. She started up with frightened eyes.
"Ethan, there's something wrong. I knew there was."
She seemed to melt against him in her terror, and he caught her in his arms, held her fast there, felt her lashes beat his cheek like netted butterflies.
"What is it? What is it?" she stammered.
But he had found her lips at last and was drinking, unconscious of everything but the joy they gave him. She lingered a moment, caught in the same strong current. Then she slipped from him and drew back a step or two, pale and troubled. Her look smote him with compunction, and he cried out, as if he saw her drowning in a dream. "You can't go, Matt. I'll never let you."
"Go? Go?" she stammered. "Must I go?"
The words went on sounding between them as though a torch of warning flew from hand to hand through a black landscape. Ethan was overcome with shame at his lack of self-control in flinging the news at her so brutally. His head reeled and he had to support himself against the table. All the while he felt as if he were still kissing her and yet dying of thirst for her lips.
"Ethan, what has happened? Is Zena mad with me?"
Her cry steadied him, though it deepened his wrath and pity. "No, no," he assured her. "It's not that. But this new doctor has scared her about herself. You know, she believes all they say the first time she sees them. And this one's told her she won't get well unless she lays up and don't do a thing about the house, not for months." He paused, his eyes wandering from her miserably. She stood silent a moment, drooping before him like a broken branch. She was so small and weak-looking that it wrung his heart. But suddenly she lifted her head and looked straight at him. "And she wants somebody handier in my place, is that it?" "That's what she says tonight."
"If she says it tonight, she'll say it tomorrow."
Both bowed to the inexorable truth. They knew that Zena never changed her mind, and that in her case a resolve once taken was equivalent to an act performed. There was a long silence between them. Then Maddie said in a low voice, "Don't be too sorry, Ethan."
"Oh, God. Oh, God," he groaned.
The glow of passion he had felt for her had melted to an aching tenderness. He saw her quick lids beating back the tears and longed to take her in his arms and soothe her. "You're letting your supper get cold," she admonished him with a pale gleam of gaiety.
"Oh, Matt, Matt, where'll you go to?"
Her lids sank and a tremor crossed her face. He saw that for the first time the thought of the future came to her distinctly.
"I might get something to do over at Stamford," she faltered, as if knowing that he knew she had no hope.
He dropped back into his seat and hid his face in his hands. Despair seized him at the thought of her setting out alone to renew the weary quest for work. In the only place where she was known, she was surrounded by indifference or animosity. And what chance had she, inexperienced and untrained, among the million bread-seekers of the cities? There came back to him miserable tales he had heard at Worcester, and the faces of girls whose lives had begun as hopefully as Maddie's. It was not possible to think of such things without a revolt of his whole being. He sprang up suddenly.
You can't go, Matt. I won't let you. She's always had her way, but I mean to have mine now.
Maddie lifted her hand with a quick gesture, and he heard his wife step behind him. Zena came into the room with her dragging down at the heel step and quietly took her accustomed seat between them.
I feel a little mite better, and Dr. Buck says I ought to eat all I can to keep my strength up, even if I ain't got any appetite, she said in her flat whine, reaching across Maddie for the teapot.
Her good dress had been replaced by the black calico and brown knitted shawl which formed her daily wear, and with them she had put on her usual face and manner. She poured out her tea, added a great deal of milk to it, helped herself largely to pie and pickles, and made the familiar gesture of adjusting her false teeth before she began to eat. The cat rubbed itself ingratiatingly against her, and she said, "Good pussy," stooped to stroke it, and gave it a scrap of meat from her plate. Ethan sat speechless, not pretending to eat, but Maddie nibbled valiantly at her food and asked Zena one or two questions about her visit to Bettsbridge. Zena answered in her everyday tone and, warming to the theme, regaled them with several vivid descriptions of intestinal disturbances among her friends and relatives. She looked straight at Maddie as she spoke, a faint smile deepening the vertical lines between her nose and chin. When supper was over, she rose from her seat and pressed her hand to the flat surface over the region of her heart.
"That pie of yours always sets a mite heavy, Matt," she said, not ill-naturedly.
She seldom abbreviated the girl's name, and when she did so, it was always a sign of affability.
"I've a good mind to go and hunt up those stomach powders I got last year over in Springfield," she continued. "I ain't tried them for quite a while, and maybe they'll help the heartburn."
Maddie lifted her eyes. "Can't I get them for you, Zena?" she ventured.
"No, they're in a place you don't know about," Zena answered darkly with one of her secret looks.
She went out of the kitchen, and Maddie, rising, began to clear the dishes from the table. As she passed Ethan's chair, their eyes met and clung together desolately. The warm, still kitchen looked as peaceful as the night before. The cat had sprung to Zena's rocking chair, and the heat of the fire was beginning to draw out the faint, sharp scent of the geraniums. Ethan dragged himself wearily to his feet. "I'll go out and take a look around," he said, going toward the passage to get his lantern. As he reached the door, he met Zena coming back into the room, her lips twitching with anger, a flush of excitement on her sallow face. The shawl had slipped from her shoulders and was dragging at her downtrodden heels, and in her hands she carried the fragments of the red glass pickle dish.
"I'd like to know who done this," she said, looking sternly from Ethan to Maddie.
There was no answer, and she continued in a trembling voice,
"I went to get those powders I'd put away in Father's old spectacle case, top of the china closet where I keep the things I set store by, so folks shan't meddle with them."
Her voice broke, and two small tears hung on her lashless lids and ran slowly down her cheeks.
"It takes the stepladder to get at the top shelf, and I put Aunt Philura Maple's pickle dish up there a purpose when we was married, and it's never been down since, except for the spring cleaning, and then I always lifted it with my own hands so's it shouldn't get broke."
She laid the fragments reverently on the table.
"I want to know who done this," she quavered.
At the challenge, Ethan turned back into the room and faced her.
"I can tell you, then. The cat done it."
"The cat?"
"That's what I said."
She looked at him hard and then turned her eyes to Maddie, who was carrying the dishpan to the table.
"I'd like to know how the cat got into my china closet," she said.
"Chasing mice, I guess," Ethan rejoined. "There was a mouse around the kitchen all last evening."
Zena continued to look from one to the other. Then she emitted her small, strange laugh.
"I knew that was a smart cat,"
she said in a high voice. But I didn't know he was smart enough to pick up the pieces of my pickle dish and lay 'em edge to edge on the very shelf he knocked 'em off of.
Maddie suddenly drew her arms out of the steaming water.
It wasn't Ethan's fault, Zena. The cat did break the dish, but I got it down from the china closet, and I'm the one to blame for its getting broken.
Zena stood beside the ruin of her treasure, stiffening into a stony image of resentment.
You cut down my pickle dish? What for?
A bright flush flew to Maddie's cheeks.
I wanted to make the supper table pretty, she said. You wanted to make the supper table pretty, and you waited till my back was turned and took the thing I set most store by of anything I've got and wouldn't never use it, not even when the minister come to dinner or Aunt Martha Pierce come over from Bettsbridge.
Zena paused with a gasp, as if terrified by her own evocation of the sacrilege.
You're a bad girl, Maddie Silver, and I always known it. It's the way your father begun, and I was warned of it when I took you up, and I tried to keep my things where you couldn't get at 'em. And now you've took from me the one I cared for most of all.
She broke off in a short spasm of sobs that passed and left her more than ever like a shape of stone.
If I'd have listened to folks, you'd have gone before now, and this wouldn't have happened, she said.
And gathering up the bits of broken glass, she went out of the room as if she carried a dead body. Chapter 8 When Ethan was called back to the farm by his father's illness, his mother gave him, for his own use, a small room behind the untenanted best parlor. Here he had nailed up shelves for his books, built himself a box sofa out of boards and a mattress, laid out his papers on a kitchen table, hung on the rough plaster wall an engraving of Abraham Lincoln, and a calendar with Thoughts from the Poets, and tried, with these meager properties, to produce some likeness to the study of a minister who had been kind to him and lent him books when he was at Worcester. He still took refuge there in summer, but when Maddie came to live at the farm, he had had to give her his stove, and consequently the room was uninhabitable for several months of the year. To this retreat he descended as soon as the house was quiet, and Zena's steady breathing from the bed had assured him that there was to be no sequel to the scene in the kitchen. After Zena's departure, he and Maddie had stood speechless, neither seeking to approach the other. Then the girl had returned to her task of clearing up the kitchen for the night, and he had taken his lantern and gone on his usual round outside the house. The kitchen was empty when he came back to it, but his tobacco pouch and pipe had been laid on the table, and under them was a scrap of paper torn from the back of a seedsman's catalog, on which three words were written, "Don't trouble, Ethan." Going into his cold, dark study, he placed the lantern on the table, and, stooping to its light, read the message again and again. It was the first time that Maddie had ever written to him, and the possession of the paper gave him a strange new sense of her nearness. Yet it deepened his anguish by reminding him that henceforth they would have no other way of communicating with each other. For the life of her smile, the warmth of her voice, only cold paper and dead words. Confused motions of rebellion stormed in him. He was too young, too strong, too full of the sap of living to submit so easily to the destruction of his hopes. Must he wear out all his years at the side of a bitter, querulous woman? Other possibilities had been in him, possibilities sacrificed, one by one, to Zena's narrow-mindedness and ignorance. And what good had come of it? She was 100 times bitterer and more discontented than when he had married her. The one pleasure left her was to inflict pain on him. All the healthy instincts of self-defense rose up in him against such waste. He bundled himself into his old coonskin coat and lay down on the box sofa to think. Under his cheek, he felt a hard object with strange protuberances. It was a cushion which Zena had made for him when they were engaged, the only piece of needlework he had ever seen her do. He flung it across the floor and propped his head against the wall. He knew a case of a man over the mountain, a young fellow of about his own age, who had escaped from just such a life of misery by going west with the girl he cared for. His wife had divorced him, and he had married the girl and prospered. Ethan had seen the couple the summer before at Shad's Falls, where they had come to visit relatives. They had a little girl with fair curls, who wore a gold locket and was dressed like a princess. The deserted wife had not done badly either. Her husband had given her the farm, and she had managed to sell it, and with that and the alimony she had started a lunchroom at Bettsbridge and bloomed into activity and importance. Ethan was fired by the thought. Why should he not leave with Mattie the next day, instead of letting her go alone? He would hide his valise under the seat of the sleigh, and Zena would suspect nothing till she went upstairs for her afternoon nap and found a letter on the bed. His impulses were still near the surface, and he sprang up, relit the lantern, and sat down at the table. He rummaged in the drawer for a sheet of paper, found one, and began to write, "Zena, I've done all I could for you, and I don't see as it's been any use. I don't blame you, nor I don't blame myself. Maybe both of us will do better separate. I'm going to try my luck west, and you can sell the farm and mill and keep the money." His pen paused on the word, which brought home to him the relentless conditions of his lot. If he gave the farm and mill to Zena, what would be left him to start his own life with? Once in the West, he was sure of picking up work. He would not have feared to try his chance alone. But with Mattie depending on him, the case was different. And what of Zena's fate? Farm and mill were mortgaged to the limit of their value, and even if she found a purchaser, in itself an unlikely chance, it was doubtful she could clear $1,000 on the sale. Meanwhile, how could she keep the farm going? It was only by incessant labor and personal supervision that Ethan drew a meager living from his land, and his wife, even if she were in better health than she imagined, could never carry such a burden alone. Well, she could go back to her people then and see what they would do for her. It was the fate she was forcing on Mattie. Why not let her try it herself? By the time she had discovered his whereabouts and brought suit for divorce, he would probably, wherever he was, be earning enough to pay her a sufficient alimony. And the alternative was to let Mattie go forth alone, with far less hope of ultimate provision. He had scattered the contents of the table drawer in his search for a sheet of paper, and as he took up his pen his eye fell on an old copy of the Bettsbridge Eagle. The advertising sheet was folded uppermost, and he read the seductive words, "Trips to the West, reduced rates." He drew the lantern nearer and eagerly scanned the fares. Then the paper fell from his hand, and he pushed aside his unfinished letter. A moment ago he had wondered what he and Mattie were to live on when they reached the West. Now he saw that he had not even the money to take her there. Borrowing was out of the question. 6 months before he had given his only security to raise funds for necessary repairs to the mill, and he knew that without security no one at Starkfield would lend him $10. The inexorable facts closed in on him like prison warders handcuffing a convict. There was no way out. None. He was a prisoner for life, and now his one ray of light was to be extinguished. He crept back heavily to the sofa, stretching himself out with limbs so leaden that he felt as if they would never move again. Tears rose in his throat and slowly burned their way to his lids. As he lay there, the window pane that faced him, growing gradually lighter, inlaid upon the darkness a square of moon-suffused sky. A crooked tree branch crossed it, a branch of the apple tree under which, on summer evenings, he had sometimes found Mattie sitting when he came up from the mill. Slowly the rim of the rainy vapors caught fire and burnt away, and a pure moon swung into the blue. Ethan, rising on his elbow, watched the landscape whiten and shape itself under the sculpture of the moon. This was the night on which he was to have taken Maddie coasting, and there hung the lamp to light them. He looked out at the slopes bathed in luster, the silver-edged darkness of the woods, the spectral purple of the hills against the sky, and it seemed as though all the beauty of the night had been poured out to mock his wretchedness. He fell asleep, and when he woke, the chill of the winter dawn was in the room. He felt cold and stiff and hungry and ashamed of being hungry. He rubbed his eyes and went to the window. A red sun stood over the gray rim of the fields, behind trees that looked black and brittle. He said to himself, "This is Matt's last day," and tried to think what the place would be without her. As he stood there, he heard a step behind him, and she entered.
"Oh, Ethan, were you here all night?"
She looked so small and pinched in her poor dress, with a red scarf wound about her and the cold light turning her paleness sallow, that Ethan stood before her without speaking.
"You must be frozen,"
she went on, fixing lusterless eyes on him. He drew a step near. "How did you know I was here?"
"Because I heard you go downstairs again after I went to bed, and I listened all night, and you didn't come up."
All his tenderness rushed to his lips. He looked at her and said, "I'll come right along and make up the kitchen fire." They went back to the kitchen, and he fetched the coal and kindlings and cleared out the stove for her, while she brought in the milk and the cold remains of the meat pie. When warmth began to radiate from the stove and the first ray of sunlight lay on the kitchen floor, Ethan's dark thoughts melted in the mellower air. The sight of Maddie going about her work as he had seen her on so many mornings made it seem impossible that she should ever cease to be a part of the scene. He said to himself that he had doubtless exaggerated the significance of Zena's threats, and that she, too, with the return of daylight, would come to a saner mood. He went up to Maddie as she bent above the stove and laid his hand on her arm. "I don't want you should trouble either," he said, looking down into her eyes with a smile. She flushed up warmly and whispered back,
"No, Ethan. I ain't going to trouble."
"I guess things will straighten out," he added. There was no answer but a quick throb of her lids, and he went on, "She ain't said anything this morning."
"No, I haven't seen her yet."
"Don't you take any notice when you do." With this injunction, he left her and went out to the cow barn. He saw Jotham Powell walking up the hill through the morning mist, and the familiar sight added to his growing conviction of security. As the two men were clearing out the stalls, Jotham rested on his pitchfork to say, "Dan'l Boone's going over to the flats today noon, and he could take Maddie's trunk along and make it easier riding when I take her over in the sleigh." Ethan looked at him blankly, and he continued, "Miss Frome said the new girl'd be at Flats at 5, and I was to take Maddie then so's she could catch the 6 o'clock train for Stamford." Ethan felt the blood drumming in his temples. He had to wait a moment before he could find voice to say, "Oh, it ain't so sure about Maddie's going." "That so?" said Jotham indifferently, and they went on with their work. When they returned to the kitchen, the two women were already at breakfast. Zena had an air of unusual alertness and activity. She drank 2 cups of coffee and fed the cat with the scraps left in the pie dish. Then she rose from her seat and, walking over to the window, snipped 2 or 3 yellow leaves from the geraniums.
"Aunt Martha's ain't got a faded leaf on 'em, but they pine away when they ain't cared for," she said reflectively.
Then she turned to Jotham and asked,
"What time did you say Dan'l Burn'd be along?"
The hired man threw a hesitating glance at Ethan.
Round about noon, he said. Zena turned to Maddie.
That trunk of yours is too heavy for the sleigh, and Dan'l Byrne'll be round to take it over to the flats, she said.
I'm much obliged to you, Zena, said Maddie.
I'd like to go over things with you first, Zena continued in an unperturbed voice. I know there's a huckabuck towel missing, and I can't take out what you done with that match safe to use to stand behind the stuffed owl in the parlor.
She went out, followed by Maddie, and when the men were alone, Jotham said to his employer, I guess I'd better let Dan'l come round then. Ethan finished his usual morning tasks about the house and barn. Then he said to Jotham, I'm going down to Starkfield. Tell them not to wait dinner. The passion of rebellion had broken out in him again. That which had seemed incredible in the sober light of day had really come to pass, and he was to assist as a helpless spectator at Maddie's banishment. His manhood was humbled by the part he was compelled to play, and by the thought of what Maddie must think of him. Confused impulses struggled in him as he strode along to the village. He had made up his mind to do something, but he did not know what it would be. The early mist had vanished, and the fields lay like a silver shield under the sun. It was one of the days when the glitter of winter shines through a pale haze of spring. Every yard of the road was alive with Maddie's presence, and there was hardly a branch against the sky or a tangle of brambles on the bank in which some bright shred of memory was not caught. Once, in the stillness, the call of a bird in a mountain ash was so like her laughter that his heart tightened and then grew large, and all these things made him see that something must be done at once. Suddenly it occurred to him that Andrew Hale, who was a kind-hearted man, might be induced to reconsider his refusal and advance a small sum of lumber if he were told that Zena's ill health made it necessary to hire a servant. Hale, after all, knew enough of Ethan's situation to make it possible for the latter to renew his appeal without too much loss of pride. And moreover, how much did pride count in the ebullition of passions in his breast? The more he considered his plan, the more hopeful it seemed. If he could get Mrs. Hale's ear, he felt certain of success, and with $50 in his pocket, nothing could keep him from Maddie. His first object was to reach Starkfield before Hale had started for his work. He knew the carpenter had a job down the Corbury Road and was likely to leave his house early. Ethan's long strides grew more rapid with the accelerated beat of his thoughts, and as he reached the foot of Schoolhouse Hill, he caught sight of Hale's sleigh in the distance. He hurried forward to meet it, but as it drew near, he saw that it was driven by the carpenter's youngest boy, and that the figure at his side, looking like a large upright cocoon in spectacles, was that of Mrs. Hale. Ethan signed to them to stop, and Mrs. Hale leaned forward, her pink wrinkles twinkling with benevolence.
"Mr. Hale? Why, yes, you'll find him down home now. He ain't going to his work this forenoon. He woke up with a touch of lumbago, and I just made him put on one of old Dr. Kidder's plasters and set right up into the fire."
Beaming maternally on Ethan, she bent over to add, I only just heard from Mr. Hale about Zena's going over to Bettsbridge to see that new doctor. I'm real sorry she's feeling so bad again. I hope he thinks he can do something for her. I don't know anybody round here's had more sickness than Zena. I always tell Mr. Hale I don't know what she'd have done if she hadn't had you to look after her. And I used to say the same thing about your mother. You've had an awful mean time, Ethan Frome.
She gave him a last nod of sympathy while her son chirped to the horse, and Ethan, as she drove off, stood in the middle of the road and stared after the retreating sleigh. It was a long time since anyone had spoken to him as kindly as Mrs. Hale. Most people were either indifferent to his troubles or disposed to think it natural that a young fellow of his age should have carried without repining the burden of 3 crippled lives. But Mrs. Hale had said, You've had an awful mean time, Ethan Frome, and he felt less alone with his misery. If the Hales were sorry for him, they would surely respond to his appeal. He started down the road toward their house,
but at the end of a few yards he pulled up sharply, the blood in his face. For the first time, in the light of the words he had just heard, he saw what he was about to do. He was planning to take advantage of the Hale sympathy to obtain money from them on false pretenses. That was a plain statement of the cloudy purpose which had driven him in headlong to Starkfield. With the sudden perception of the point to which his madness had carried him, the madness fell, and he saw his life before him as it was. He was a poor man, the husband of a sickly woman, whom his desertion would leave alone and destitute. And even if he had had the heart to desert her, he could have done so only by deceiving two kindly people who had pitied him. He turned and walked slowly back to the farm.